I'm told that people from all over the world listen to this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields, with me, Terry Wenham. People from Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, India and the States, as well as from all around Europe. People that perhaps have a family connection or simply an interest in the far-off Great War, both in distance and now time. Time. Something I often think about in those silent cities designed so superbly by the likes of Blomfield, Lutyens and Baker. The clock continues to tick. I can hear my grandfather clock ticking now. Time never stops, does it? The men and women in the cemeteries become more distant memories with every passing moment. Distance. A short hop across the channel for us in the UK. A vast journey into the unknown for the majority of the Allied and German soldiers. A one-way journey for many. Time and distance, both measurable and tangible. Emotions and feelings are much more difficult to express and indeed measure, or even understand, especially when considering events that took place so long ago, yet affect us today in so many different ways. So time, distance, emotions, all connect us with those battlefields of the Western Front and beyond. When I'm guiding people to Tynecott, the largest silent city of them all, people often struggle to comprehend the scale of the loss by looking at the nearly 12,000 headstones. But I ask them to consider the impact of each soldier's death. Imagine each one of them individually standing behind their own headstones. Easy to imagine when the late afternoon sun throws shadows. Shadows of those headstones, echoes of those lost men. These thoughts are easy to appreciate in places like Tynecott. We try to express how these beautiful locations look today compared to the destructions of the now out of living memory past. This is part of the reason why this podcast exists. But when we visit the off-the-beaten-track cemeteries and find very few entries in the visitor's book, those same feelings and emotions are still there. An isolated battlefield cemetery with 40 graves is very atmospheric in a very different way to places like Tynecott. Time, distance, emotions, they're still there. Each individual headstone is a story waiting to be told. Another page in someone's history, somewhere in the world, somewhere in time. So this brings me to this week's stories I've researched, some for relatives, some before I found a connection to another battlefield story. None of them have ever been told before. All of them are just as important as those men that were decorated for their achievements. Rank or even bravery. They all deserve to be remembered. So here goes, just a few stories of those men that served and died on the battlefields of the Western Front. These are just thoughts that occurred to me last night, a Sunday evening, as I sat there with a glass of wine, looking out into the peaceful setting of my own garden. My mind drifted off again to the Western Front, where I'll be several times in the next few weeks for different reasons. And these thoughts and words came into my head, so I thought I'd better write them down and share them with you today. But here goes. Here's the first story I want to share with you today. And it concerns two brothers. Not unusual, lots of brothers died in the Great War. I stumbled upon their story when I was going through the archives of our local newspaper here in Northampton. And there was the photograph of these two young lads, Gunner William Taylor from the Royal Field Artillery. Newspaper tells us that Mr. and Mrs. T. Taylor of Weedon in Northamptonshire have learned of the death of their son, who's died from wounds in the base hospital. This is the third son that Mr. and Mrs. Taylor have lost in the war. Commonwealth War Graves Commission tells us that William was serving with the 112th Battery of the 24th Brigade Royal Field Artillery, and he succumbed to his wounds on the 31st of January 1916. He wasn't at a base hospital. The base hospitals were on the coast. He was in one of those enormous casualty clearing stations, which then were called Remy Siding, but we now know as Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery. He's buried in Plot 4, Row C, Grave number 45. But in the photograph published in the newspaper of William, next to him is a much younger face. It's the photograph of his younger brother, his 16-year-old younger brother. Too young, of course, to be out there. Too young to be serving as an infantry soldier. He was, in fact, a trumpeter. Trumpeter Horace Taylor. And not far from Lichtenhoek, which is near Poppering, is a small churchyard called Nove Eglise Churchyard. There's a scattering of graves here from the early part of the war, and there's a gap, and there's some more from 1918 as the war passed that way again in those last few months. And it's in that churchyard that Horace is buried, service number 71639. He was also serving with the Royal Field Artillery, like his older brother, but in the headquarters. As I say, he was a trumpeter. He died on the 25th of February 1915. His service record I managed to find in the National Archives, and it tells us his height. He wasn't even 5 foot tall. He was 4 foot 11 and a half inches. And he signed up in January of 1913. Their unit's war diary for that day tells us that not a lot was happening. It was a very clear day, but the enemy were shelling the battery headquarters, which were billets in a residential house. They were being bombarded with high explosive shells, and because the walls of the house were thin, pieces of shells had penetrated those thin walls. The diary tells us that there were two casualties, one driver and one trumpeter killed. And the trumpeter, as we know, was 16-year-old Horace. So let's hope that Horace was killed outright and that he didn't suffer too much. But I'm afraid his brother must have suffered, because his unit's diary tells us that he was wounded by shell fire 10 days before he died at Lichtenhoek, at Remy Siding. The facilities at Lichtenhoek, those casualty clearing stations by this time, had started to be quite sophisticated. Let's hope they were sophisticated enough to look after him, that he didn't suffer too much. He must have done, mustn't he? Shell fire. Up to 10 days before he succumbed. I'll be at Lichtenhoek next week. I'll be paying my respects to him. A couple of weeks ago, I went to see Horace's grave. Placed his photograph against the headstone. I touched the top of his headstone and I thought of that young boy. Photos of all of the soldiers that we're talking about this week I'll put on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. Back home in Weedon in Northamptonshire, remember the original article said that they'd lost three sons to the war. Thomas and Mary were the parents. In 1911, on the census, it reveals that they had five sons. The youngest, Lawrence, was just 2 years old. They also had two daughters. But their suffering didn't end with the fighting on the Western Front. Cecil, in 1915, one of the sons, he was 11 years old. In between the death of William and Horace, he died of natural causes in the third quarter of 1915. I wonder if they did ever manage to recover from losing three sons to the war and another one to natural causes. How could you possibly get over that? But people did. They had to, didn't they? What choice did they have? In February of 1916, just a couple of weeks after William Taylor had been killed, There was a man called Ilston Stevenson. He was serving with the 7th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And they were holding the line at Railway Wood near Ypres. This is the Belvedere Ridge, which we did a podcast from live a few weeks ago. This was after that battle in June 1915, where the lines hadn't really moved. And the North Ants, as I said, were holding the line there. The Germans were very close, just 70, 80 yards away. And Stevenson was a lieutenant, and he was sent out on patrol to gain information from the German trench opposite. But his patrol, him and another officer, they were spotted by the enemy and they threw hand grenades at the British. The other officer managed to get back. He left behind Stevenson. Stevenson was now missing. And that telegram that families dreaded receiving was sent to his parents, handwritten. It said, "Regret to inform you that Lieutenant I.H. Stevenson, North Ants Regiment, missing the 16th of February. This does not necessarily mean that he is killed or wounded. Please state next of kin." And I suppose, whilst being horrified at the contents of that, there was some hope there, wasn't there, that their young son was perhaps still alive. Perhaps he was wounded. Perhaps he was still out there somewhere, trying to find his way back, or perhaps he'd been taken prisoner by the Germans. His file as an officer is in the National Archives in Kew, and I went down there and I got the file out, and I found a number of reports in there because, understandably, the parents wanted to know what had happened. They wanted more evidence. Was their son alive? Was he coming back? There was a Private Smith. He was wounded and was in the base hospital at Etaples, and he gave a statement. He said that Stevenson was a sniping officer and he went out with Lieutenant Hadley, the bombing officer, who's still at the front. They ran into a German listening post and were bombed. Lieutenant Hadley came back. "I'm a bomber and I was with the snipers, and this was given out to us." Lieutenant Hadley and Sergeant Linnell, the sniper sergeant now at the front, went out with three or four men the same night to search for him, but they could find no trace at all. Major Mobbs, that's the famous Edgar Mobbs, who was the commanding officer at the time, reported to the friends that Lieutenant Stevenson was killed, and there was believed to be no chance that he could be a prisoner, as they were bombing heavily. Now, Edgar Mobbs, as I say, was the commanding officer at the time of that particular unit. He was a major. He was later to become a lieutenant colonel before being killed at Passchendaele in 1917. And he was famous, if that's the right word, for taking the care to write home to the relatives of the dead. And he wrote a letter to the parents just a day after this action on the 17th of February 1916. He said, "Dear Mr. Stevenson, I'm very sorry to have to write to you with such bad news, but your son has, I'm afraid, been killed. His duty took him on a patrol last night with our bombing officer. They were fired at and bombed by the Huns, and only the bombing officer got back, and I'm afraid he must have been killed, as we sent another patrol out to look for him, but nothing could be found of him. I'm very sorry for your great loss. The battalion has lost a good officer." I enclose a letter that was left in his dugout. "His other things will be returned to you as soon as we get out of the trenches. Yours sincerely, Edgar Mobbs." Frustratingly, the letter that Edgar talks about was not in the file, so I don't know what that said. Now, in some of the personal accounts that were in the file, they'd obviously been dictated and typed by someone else. They refer to the bombing officer who was with Stevenson as being a man called Hadley, but he wasn't. He was called Adderley. And as we know, he came back unscathed, no doubt shaken by what had happened to him. But that was Second Lieutenant Douglas Adderley. He was 25 years old when, in the following year, on the 16th of June 1917, he was also killed. He also has no known grave, and he's also remembered on panel 43 of the Men in Gate in Ypres. And when I went and placed a photograph of Stevenson against his name, I noticed that Adderley's name was on the same panel, just a few inches away. it's good to be able to see their names now. As we know, the restoration work on the Menin Gate's been going on for about 18 months, is now completed. And I was able to wander up the steps and find those names and pay my respects to them, something that we hadn't been able to do for some time. But of course, back home, the implications of the death of Ilston Stevenson had a major effect, not just emotionally, but financially on the family. Like so many others, Stevenson's received no further news of any kind from the front line. And it wasn't until September of 1916, so 7 months later, that it was assumed officially that he'd died on that night. His father wrote several letters to the War Office asking for more information. And in one of them, he called the Germans bloody swine. Understandable, really. Feelings must have been running very high. And in another letter, Mr. Stevenson said that he couldn't work anymore and that his son was paying the rent on the home that he shared with his wife. And he also gave his mother a monthly allowance and that the rent on their private accommodation was 6 months overdue. They hadn't paid the rent since Ilston had died. Stevenson's father was working as an architect. The need for architects had stopped because of the war, and he's receiving no income himself. And in one of the letters, he said that he hoped to find work when war was over. But this was 1916. He didn't know it, but the war had still got another 2 years to run, hadn't it? Now, I don't know how they managed to survive financially, but they did. And Ilston's father, who was called George, died in 1928. And his obituary in the local paper said that he was 67 years old when he died from a short illness that caused his heart to stop. But it says that he was engaged in business up to the time of his illness. He was known as a skillful architect with a genuine sense of beauty, and examples of his work in Northampton and other parts of the country will keep his name remembered. And most importantly, as far as I'm concerned, because if you remember, he was so worried that he wouldn't be able to keep the home that he lived in for so many years with his wife and family. He did keep that home, and that's where he died peacefully on that day in 1928. As for Rosa, George's widow, and Ilston's mum, in 1939, on the eve of the Second World War, I find her living in Peterborough with one of her other sons, Rupert. And she lived until 1958, when she died at the ripe old age of 93. She was born in the middle of the 19th century. She'd lived through the reign of Queen Victoria. She'd lived through two world wars. She'd seen so much history, so much tragedy in her own life. What memories she must have had in her long life. What experiences she must have had. Time, the word that we started this podcast with. Rosa lived for a lot of time, didn't she? This next story takes us to the other side of the wire, to the German side. We get a German perspective on what was happening in the Battle of Third Ypres, Passchendaele, in the summer of 1917. And for this story, I'm thankful to Ralph Whitehead, who shared this story on his Facebook page, World War One German History. At some stage, I'm going to ask Ralph to come on the podcast because he's got a lot of stories to tell. But this story is about a musketeer called Paul Berger, who was born in October 1896 near Stuttgart. He was a single man and listed as an unskilled worker when he joined the army in September of 1915. And in late August of 1916, he was wounded by shell splinters near Beaumont-Hamel on the Somme. It affected his left upper arm, his right lower leg and his left wrist. And it was some months before he returned to a different unit that by now was in front of the village of Langemark. The British had tried a couple of times already to take this destroyed village. And on the 22nd of August, he was killed at 4 p.m. by a direct hit from an artillery projectile. In other words, a shell. We know that his remains were buried where he fell on the battlefield, but they've never been recovered or if they have been recovered, they've never been identified. Perhaps he's one of those that's buried in the Langemark Cemetery nearby. But the regimental history for his unit gives us an idea of what it must have been like in the front line that day when young Paul was killed. It says the regiment was to become acquainted with the Englishman's Flemish fencing style. If its pilots noticed traffic in the reinforced concrete camp, and I suppose from that they mean the pillboxes, or if it suited his plans, he would conduct well-directed firing at the blocks with heavy and very heavy calibre, forcing the occupants to retreat into shell craters to avoid the fire and watch as the dugouts were shattered by the heavy shells. Even the frontline garrison had no other means of protection than to retreat to areas of low fire. When heavy fire erupted, the crater garrison would perform agile leaps sideways, backwards and mostly forwards to avoid being buried. But this constant alertness and restless relocation exhausted the troops immensely, and casualties were unavoidable. The British soon reorganised the new protective measures and found a countermeasure. In addition to heavy shells that drove the garrison to their deaths, they placed several light, heavily fragmenting high explosive shells or shrapnel to wound those trying to escape. Sleep and rest were out of the question, and the regiment was therefore forced to rotate battalions every 3 days. Coats and tent canvas offered the only protection against rain, wind and the cold. The number of illnesses and colds increased from day to day, and the regiment's strength slowly crumbled without any actual days of battle. I think that passage in itself explains why so many people died in that third battle of Ypres at Passchendaele, and why so many of them today still have no known grave, and it's highly likely that they will never have a known grave. And again, it's why it's so important that we remember them today. Paul Berger was 21 years old when he died, or not quite 21. Photograph that Ralph put on Facebook shows him holding his rifle with his Picabelle helmet on, no doubt taken in the studio back home in Germany before he went to the Western Front. Again, I'll put this photograph on the podcast page of my website, and you'll see there's a young man with a rather stern look on his face, looking back at the camera, wondering what the future holds for him, wondering whether he'd ever see home again. An image that forms the background of this photograph, of course, is a home that he never did see again. Time and distance. These men that we're talking about this week never saw their homes again. They were fighting, as we've said so many times, for their pals, for their families, for themselves, of course, but also for their country. I vow to thee, my country, here is played and sang by the band of His Majesty's Royal Marines. Thank you. course, we know, don't we, that it's not just men that contributed so much to the war effort in so many different ways. There's the story of a little girl called Ruby Crane. From just 3 years old, she spent her days at the St Dunstan's Rehabilitation Centre in Brighton, helping blinded soldiers returning from the battlefields of the Great War. Her father was the head gardener there, and as she wandered round the grounds, she would take the soldiers by the hand and guide them to their workshops, asking them where they wanted to go. She knew they couldn't see, and she just wanted to help in any way that she could. Her kindness deeply moved all those around her. People sent dolls and toys to thank her for the support she gave to the men and women who'd lost their sight. She was so loved that she appeared on the front page of the St Dunstan's annual report in 1916, and later Flag Day emblems were designed in her honour. As an adult, Ruby spoke about those times in the Great War. She said, "I always remember how my little hands seemed so small in their big hands. They were so pleased to have a child come and talk to them. It was something different, away from the monotonous grind of not being able to see things." Ruby lived a long life. She passed away in 2011 in her late 90s. But the legacy of her kindness lives on, and I'm sure all those blind men and women that were helped by Ruby never forgot her. And we're not forgetting her now, are we? There's an incredible photograph of Ruby. She's older than three, I think, in this photo, maybe four or five, holding the hands of one of those blinded soldiers. And again, I'll put that on the podcast page of my website. For this next story, I'm very grateful to Scott Bennett, who came on the podcast a few months ago to talk about his book, The Nameless Names. And Scott showed me a photograph, or he posted it on Facebook, actually, of an elderly couple from Australia commemorating their son, who was called Albert Hooker. And they're at the Anzac Day ceremony in a place called Mackay. And there's also a wonderful photograph of Albert himself with his arms folded, his Australian slouch hat on. But he's on the Menin Gate. He's one of those, once again, that didn't return from the battlefields. But Arthur and Alice, his parents, they attended the ceremony from 1918 onwards. It represented an important way to commemorate Albert, who was their only son. He'd been killed on that dreadful day, the 9th of October 1917, on the Passchendaele Ridge. A shell had killed him and three of his comrades. They had precious little information about where he was buried. There was a sketchy letter from one of their son's mates, and he said that he had buried him and that he'd attended to Albert's grave. The letter prompted Mary, who was obviously very anxious, to write to Albert's commanding officer in 1919, and she said, "I'd like to ask if any further word regarding the burial of my dead son." She then offered a heartfelt apology. She said, "I hope you'll excuse one for troubling you, but as he was my only child, you'll perhaps understand my feelings." Eventually, Mary received a reply from the base records, which said, "It is regretted that there is no record of a burial place. Due to the nature of the operation at the time, the probability was that no burial took place." Maybe Albert's mate was just trying to give Arthur and Alice some comfort. But that letter from Albert's mate conflicted with the account that she'd been given, so she persisted with her inquiries. And the authorities responded by making efforts to try and locate Albert's mate to seek answers, but they couldn't find him. As it turned out, the reason why Albert's burial location couldn't be found was recorded within his record. And perhaps mercifully, the blunt statement within it was never shared with Mary and Arthur. The note simply said, "More than likely, they were blown to pieces." Mary and Arthur continued to attend the Anzac ceremony up to their deaths in the 1940s. If you go to the Menin Gate now, like I did last week, you can see Albert's name. He was Private 5688 Albert James Arthur Hooker. He was serving with the 26th Battalion of the Australian Infantry, the AIF. He was 22 years old, and you'll find his name on panel number 23. This next story concerns a man that did actually return from the battlefields. He returned from a prisoner of war camp in Germany, but he didn't survive because eventually the treatment that he received in the prisoner of war camp were to cause his death. And his name was Private 6712 George Wells, who was serving with the Cheshire Regiment. He eventually died on the 2nd of October 1918 at the age of 35. And he's buried here in Northampton in the Toaster Road Cemetery. And during War Graves Week, between the 2nd and the 11th of May, I will tell his story when we carry out, on behalf of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, a tour of this cemetery. Many of these tours will take place wherever you live. If you go onto the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, you'll find details of them. If you type in War Graves Week, we'll be doing four of them here in Northampton. And as I say, George's story is one that we will tell. There's a photograph that appeared in our local newspaper, which started off the story, and it's entitled Northampton Martyr to German Brutality. And a return prisoner to death, it says, is an object lesson for pacifists. And there's a photograph of George there, holding on to some wooden crutches, his wife standing behind him, her name was Florence, and two young girls. And the article says, to the already appalling list of victims of horrible cruelty at the hands of the Huns is to be added Private George Wells, whose pitifully maimed body was laid to rest in Toaster Road Cemetery with military honours on Tuesday. He leaves a widow with three young children. One of them is a baby boy, 2 years old, and two little girls. The reporter says, when I called upon the widow to sympathise with her in her trouble, I found her tenderly nursing the baby, which is very ill, and the poor woman seemed almost crushed by her troubles. She, however, murmured fervent thanks for the friends she had found to help her in her hour of necessity, and speaking of her husband, she added, everyone liked him, he was so patient amid all his sufferings. Few had suffered more than during the last 14 months that he was a prisoner of war, and his death in Northampton Hospital last week, through internal complications, was entirely due to the callous cruelty inflicted upon him in a notorious camp at Wittenberg. He'd been murdered by the Germans just as much as though he'd fallen by an assassin's hand. And his case fills one with a fervent hope that the fiends responsible for his death will be dragged before a court of the Allies to be tried and punished like the criminals that they are. Don't forget, this is October 1918. The language is very strong because we'd been at war for 4 years, more than 4 years now. The casualties were so high. It's not a surprise that people felt like this. The article goes on to tell us that Wells returned to Northampton in early 1916 with both feet amputated and such a physical wreck that his wife assured me she hardly recognised him. After going to Roehampton to be fitted with artificial feet, he returned to Northampton and found a good friend of W.P. Cross and gave him light employment as a timekeeper. Not long before Wells died, he wrote a signed statement of his experiences. He says, I was captured at a village close to Las Labas on October the 22nd, 1914, and the Germans, after taking our overcoats, putties and hats and the best boots off our feet, marched us about 14 miles. We were taken to the cathedral, and some of us received rather harsh treatment from the bayonets of the sentries. To eat during the fortnight we were there, we were given 5 slices of bread a day, 1 pint of coffee and 1 pint of cabbage water. There was about 600 of us together in the cathedral, French and English. We were told we were going to be moved to a better camp, but all along the line the train stopped at every station, where the truck doors were flung open, and the people stoned and spat at us. It was about 35 hours ride in cattle trucks, 40 men in a truck. The reception we got when arriving at Wittenberg was lining up and beating us into the camp, which was on the railway siding, whilst they sang their national anthem and the people stoned and threw all sorts of missiles at us. If we were caught speaking to a comrade through the wiring tanglement, they would send along trained dogs to hold us while the sentries came up and flogged us. On several occasions, I've seen men tied to a pole with their feet above the ground. For small offences, floggings were very frequent, more so amongst the Russians. When the typhus fever was raging through the camp, the Germans left the camp for some time, except the sentries on the outside. Then they sent down six of our captured Royal Army Medical Corps officers to attend to us. After attending to us for some time, the last three officers fell with the typhus and died, and I myself, after acting as orderly for about 6 weeks to the men that were sick with typhus, fell with it. It flew to my feet and gangrene set in. I laid for about 5 weeks and then Captain Vidal amputated my feet, with the result that I only have half feet, mere stumps. We lost hundreds with this typhus in the camp. It was dreadful to see what we had to do with them. And I've seen as many as 7 corpses on top of each other in a little hut. Whilst I was orderly, we had to put them in a little hut until the Germans fetched them away. They were given no military funeral, the same as we gave theirs, but I might say that things were better towards the last little time that I was there. No doubt his family, Florence, and the children attended his funeral. We can only imagine how Florence must have felt, being left behind with a small army pension and having to look after those 3 children. What happened to those children? I don't know what happened to the boy. He'd been born in 1916. I can't find him on any of the records. Florence herself died at the tragically early age of 42 in 1928. The following year, Doris, one of those little girls, she got married in 1929, but she also died at a young age in 1945, at the age of just 38. But Kathleen, the other daughter, she got married in 1940 and she lived until 1998 when she died at the age of 87. And then taking ourselves back to the Ypres salient, near Bosingay, there's a cemetery, Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery, called the Bard Cottage Cemetery. There are over 1,600 burials in the Great War at Bard Cottage, and one of them is a man called Harold Fitness, and he was serving as a gunner in the 309th Siege Battery of the Honourable Artillery Company. And in 1916, the year before, he'd married a lady called Dorothy. Both Harold and Dorothy were well known here in Northampton, and the local paper tells us that a wedding of much interest took place at the Abington Avenue Congregational Church on Wednesday, when Private Harold Fitness married Miss Dorothy Swan. The Reverend Larkman conducted the ceremony. Now, Larkman crops up quite a lot when I've been researching the stories of Northampton, because he signs so many of the officers' attestation forms. But on this day, he was carrying out the ceremony of wedding of Harold and Dorothy. The article says that the ceremony, as wartime etiquette demands, was of very quiet and simple nature, although many relatives and friends of the bride and bridegroom were present. The bride looked very charming in a costume which was navy blue. She also had a diamond ring, the gift of the bridegroom, on her finger. After the wedding breakfast, the happy pair left almost immediately for Bournemouth, where their short honeymoon is being spent. The bride and bridegroom received many beautiful presents. Among them was one of a silver napkin rings from the employees of Mr. Fitness's shop in the drapery. But sadly, just 18 months later, their marriage was to come to an end because Harold, on the 17th of September 1917, was another one of those to perish in the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres. A newspaper article tells us that he was killed in action, a shell splinter going through the heart. He joined the forces at the beginning of 1916 and went to the front in April last. He was associated with his father in the business in the drapery. He was a young man of the highest character, bright, genial and helpful, and a very large circle of friends were here with grief of his death. A piece of shrapnel, it says, that entered his heart, the same heart that he'd given to Dorothy. Just a few months before, she chose the words for his headstone. She said, "In God's good keeping." What happened to Dorothy? Well, she did go on and get married again. She found love again. And she lived until 1991, when she died at the very old age of 96. I wonder if she always remembered Harold. I'd like to think so. And a few months ago, I went to Bard Cottage with a photograph of Harold and Dorothy, and I placed that in front of the headstone. It's probably not there now. I'll have to do that again next time I go. How many more stories must there be very similar to that? Now, this next story doesn't really concern an individual. It concerns a place on the Somme. A few weeks ago, we talked about Bazentin-le-Petit, a village that was taken by the British during the Battle of Bazentin Ridge on the 14th of July 1916, the famous Dawn attack. And in a recent visit over to the battlefields, I had discovered a photograph of a German soldier in Bazentin in 1915, which of course at that stage was quite a way behind the German lines. And in that photograph, he's standing in front of the village church. And in the photograph, I could see in the distance a chateau that had been hit by shellfire. The roof of it was damaged. And in front of that was a statue, which I later found out was named after a local man called Lamarck. And as I do when I go to the battlefields, if I get the chance, I like to line up these photographs and see what they look like now, see what that position looks like now. Because, of course, this photograph that was taken in 1915 shows Bazentin as it was then. But the following year, it was completely destroyed by shellfire during the Battle of the Somme. And then, as they all these villages were, rebuilt afterwards. But when we stood there looking at this location, we saw that it looked very different. Now, if you're going over to the Somme at any stage, I would suggest you go and have a look for yourself, because there's an information board there in Bazentin-le-Petit. If you follow the road that goes from Contalmaison towards Longueval, you'll have the large expanse of Mametz Wood on the right-hand side, and on the left-hand side there's a turn-in up into Bazentin village itself, Bazentin-le-Petit. And if you drive up the hill before very long, you'll find the church in front of you. And as I say, on the left-hand side, there's an information board. But the photograph from 1915 showing the church looks very different. It was rebuilt in a completely different style. But you can tell we're in the right place because there's a bank with some steps outside and you can line that up with the photograph. And there's this single German soldier stood in front of the church facing the camera. But the memorial on the left-hand side wasn't there. The memorial was now where the chateau was once standing behind the church right in front of us. But there were signs of the chateau still there. The chateau was never rebuilt. A photograph on that information board there shows two more Germans standing outside the chateau behind the church. Again, it shows signs of shell damage. But on the door, on either side of the door, were two red flags indicating that the Germans were using this as a medical facility. And as I say, after the war, it was never rebuilt. And the Lamarck Memorial was placed on the location where the chateau was. So we walked up the road, and it was incredible to find evidence that the chateau was once there, because there were remains of it. There was a wall, perhaps, I don't know, a metre high, all around the perimeter of a small field, and that showed the outline of where the chateau once stood. And there was a gap where that door was, where that Red Cross flag was on the door to indicate to everybody that this was a medical facility. It was very quiet. There's no one around. It's a beautiful spring day. Very eerie to stand there, knowing that shell after shell destroyed that building like it did all those buildings. Knowing that many a German man, and perhaps British men as well, prisoners of war, were treated where we were standing. Knowing that some of those would have died. Then as I stood there, I looked across to the right, and across another field, just a few yards away, was one of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries in Bazentin. It's well off the beaten track. People clearly go to Mametz Wood. They go to Longueval. They go to see High Wood and Delville Wood and a highly impressive Caterpillar Valley Cemetery that's just along the road. But perhaps they don't turn into Bazentin, but I recommend that you do that. It's worth it. You get those feelings again that we talked about at the start of this podcast, of distance, of time, of emotions. You can almost feel that on a quiet day. You can feel that anywhere on the Somme or at Ypres. But if you've got somewhere like this where you can actually see the tangible evidence of what once stood there, it makes it in some way all the more real. You can almost touch the past. You can hear the echoes of what once went on inside that now long gone chateau. It reminds us of how important it is to visit the battlefields. It's a reminder to me as I stood there that it's so important to get off that beaten track, to go looking for things that have perhaps been forgotten about, that don't appear in the guidebooks that you won't go to on coach tours. These locations on the Western Front and beyond remain very special to us. The spirits of those people, whether they survived or not, are still there. And I suppose it was that location and the stories that we've talked about today that brought those thoughts of time and distance and emotions into my mind last night. That's what inspired this podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed putting it together. Next week, we're out on the battlefields on a private tour. We'll be visiting Ypres and the Somme, and we'll also be visiting a place, a location from the Second World War, from the retreat to Dunkirk, a place where something dreadful happened to men from the Norfolk Regiment as they tried to fight the German army and the SS in particular. We're going to go there. Our journey takes us there because one of the people that I'd be guiding, his relative was there. He died where this awful incident took place. So if everything goes to plan, I'm going to record part of the podcast from that location next week, and we'll tell the stories of those men from Norfolk that died in the spring of 1940. But until then, thank you once again for tuning in to the podcast. Really grateful for all the reviews that I receive and the ratings that people put onto Apple and Spotify in particular. And it's also great to hear from people as well with their own stories. We'll never ever stop learning new stories. We'll never stop learning about the Great War. And as we say goodbye for this week, once again, we'll remember all of these men by the plane of the last post.